From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. William Buckley, the founder of the big conservative magazine National Review, once wrote that the magazine stands athwart history, yelling stop at a time when no one is inclined to do so. In their latest issue, the magazine is yelling stop Donald Trump. The huge headline, huge, the Donald might say, across the cover, against Trump. And essay after essay saying why Donald Trump is not conservative and should not be president. This hour on Point, the National Review versus Donald Trump and the fracturing of the Republican Party. We'll talk with the editor of the National Review, Rich Lowry, about the raging struggle within the GOP and why he's against Trump. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of these big conservative voices coming out against Trump? What about Ted Cruz and the rest? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Rich Lowry joins us in a moment. Joining us first from Des Moines, Iowa, is Jonathan Martin, national political correspondent for The New York Times. He's been writing very compellingly about the kind of civil war within the GOP. Jonathan Martin, welcome back to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Against Trump, huge letters, kind of gold and shiny letters, just like Trump might have used.
Trumpian
letters. How big a deal is this? Does the Donald just roll right over this? Or within this world, is this huge?
I think it has an impact among, a sort of shaming impact among the conservative and the GOP intelligentsia. I don't think a lot of people who are just sort of day-to-day voters are going to necessarily go into the polling place and say, wow, there was that National Review manifesto and that's going to sort of move me. But I do think the impact on voters could be the kind of media echo that it's got. You know, it has gotten substantial coverage. Here we are on Tuesday talking about something that came out last Thursday night, mm-hmm. And I think that, in fact, could have an impact because it has received a lot of coverage, which has just sort of, you know, further laid out some of the conservative flaws when it comes to Trump, some of the flaws that he has in the minds of conservatives. So I think that's really the impact. But we're at a remarkable moment here. And I think it's almost an historic moment in some ways. We could look back to 2016 and see this election as a real realignment in the Republican Party when it moved to a much more populist orientation. There's been these kind of fissures for a while now between kind of small government traditional conservatives who are pro free trade, who are for federalism, for reducing taxes, reforming entitlements. That's not what is driving the Trump voters. It's much more of a kind of nationalist and populist, almost European-style brand of conservatism. And I think you could see a really historic change if Trump does become the party standard bearer.
I mean, here's the National Review calling him a menace, and that's almost the least of it. And then that's the editors of the Review. And then you've got this parade of very prominent conservatives on and on right down. David Boaz, Cato Institute, he's effectively vowing to be an American Mussolini, he writes in the pages of National Review.
Incredible.
Katie Bavlich saying he's a political con man who sympathizes with hitman Vladimir Putin.
Right.
Michael Mukasey, former U.S. Attorney General, we don't need a president who, quoting him here, who summons applause with tantrums and homicidal fantasies. And,
yeah.
I mean, and on it goes. Michael Medved, the uncomfortable, unavoidable issue of racism with Donald Trump, and write down, this is very, very
tough stuff.
It's almost Trumpian in its flamboyance.
Tough stuff. Yeah, and, you know, I actually read about this last week, and it reminded me of the magazine's founder, William F. Buckley, sort of casting out the Birchers from the conservative movement. He famously confronted the John Birch Society adherents in 1962, and I think this recalls that, where you've got a real pivot point in history where philosophical conservatives see a existential threat to the conservative movement, and they are standing up and speaking out.
We'll ask Rich Lowry how he defines that threat. You've written very compellingly about this debate going on within the GOP now among what you call conservative intellectuals, but maybe not just them, about who's the greater threat to traditional conservatism or the mainstream Republican Party as we've known it, Donald Trump or Ted Cruz? Yeah. Describe that debate,
sure.
Jonathan.
Sure. there are basically two camps. What I call the conservative intellectuals, which are basically writers from magazines like the National Review and the Weekly Standard. It's people who are in think tanks. It's the sort of folks in the party who are in politics or are in public affairs because they care about the ideas and the principles of conservatism. Okay, that's one camp.
Okay.
The other camp is more the kind of permanent political class, lobbyists, elected officials, staffers, strategists. So the conflict is between those two different camps, and it's pretty simple. It's about which is more important, ideas or power. And this is a sort of age-old question when it comes to politics is you've got folks that are more invested in principles and ideas, and you've got folks who are more invested in political power. And that's where it breaks down. And the people who are the intellectual class, the thinkers, they care more about the ideas behind the conservative movement that is part of the Republican Party. And they believe that Trump is more of a menace because he is not moored to the conservative movement. He's really not a conservative. When it comes to the political class, their interests are much more short-term, and they are concerned about power and access, and they believe that Trump would effectively be a problematic candidate, but one who is not a longer-term threat to their influence, okay? And to put it in shorthand, the establishment folks basically would rather rent the party to Trump for 4 months than risk giving it to Cruz for 4 years.
The establishment, i.e. the power brokers, lobbyists, okay, and strategists, they write, you quote
and
Richard—
politicians.
Politicians. You quote Richard Holt saying, we can live with Trump. Now, why do they think they can live with Trump, but they just can't stomach, in this case, Ted Cruz?
Because they don't think Trump actually could be president. So effectively, you would be giving him the nomination, and he would only be the leader of the party for the next 4 months. Furthermore, they think that he would kind of rely on them and wouldn't necessarily interfere with their power and control because he's Trump. He's a deal maker. He's a business guy. He's flexible. He's not going to sort of shut them out and try to create his own separate power structure.
And Ted Cruz, what's the fear?
And with Cruz, the fear is this, that he would actually seize control of the party, move it ideologically to the right, and squeeze them and sort of limit their access and influence. And this— Trump or Cruz, in both cases, the establishment thinks they are surefire election day losers this fall. The difference, though, is they believe that the Trump, being 69 years old, would probably fade away, wouldn't try to run again in 2020. The fear is that if Cruz is the nominee and he loses this year, he's coming back. He's going to start running the next day for 2020.
What about National Review? They've got some essays in their pages with some pretty tough swipes against Ted Cruz, too. It's not all against Trump.
Oh, absolutely. Look, the conservative intellectuals are mixed when it comes to Ted Cruz. A lot of them aren't terribly fond of Ted Cruz, but they just don't view Cruz as somebody who is a sort of existential threat to conservatism because they see Cruz as somebody who, you know, might be more conservative than is viable for the general election, might be personally hard to kind of stomach because they view him as cynical or what have you. So it's not like they're in love with Ted Cruz. They just want to stop Trump. In fact, if you look at the conservative sort of intellectual class, some of them are more Cruz-friendly, but there are plenty who would prefer Rubio.
You know, this all makes it sound like it's one big talking shop, but it's anything but that. I mean, the Iowa caucuses, as you well know, being there in Des Moines, they're right around the corner, New Hampshire, right after that. What do the thinkers slash power brokers want to do about this circumstance where they're maybe not happy with either front runner?
The thinkers would like to find a way to stop Trump, and amazingly, 6 days before the caucuses, you don't see a kind of sustained campaign to stop Trump on the airwaves, which is remarkable. The establishment, the kind of power brokers, they want to stop Trump and Cruz. And they're trying to figure out how to do that. But this is multidimensional chess, Tom. It's complicated. Look, I have a story today with my colleague Alex Burns on the Times website, nytimes.com, talking about how increasingly there's frustration among the establishment that their cadre of candidates, Bush, Kasich, Christie, Rubio, they're beating the heck out of each other instead of focusing their fire more on Cruz and Trump. And there's concern that there's so much international warfare among the establishment candidates, the sort of circular firing squad has been counterproductive. They say is this, that if there is one establishment candidate who comes out of Iowa and New Hampshire ahead of the other establishment candidates, then at that point it's time to consolidate around that candidate and the other three should drop out of the race.
We've got people writing, calling in, saying the Republican establishment created Cruz and Trump, sort of, you know, dealt in anger and fear, and now it's coming back to bite. What do you say?
Oh, I work for the New York Times. I hear that all the time, Tom. What do you think?
Oh, credible or not?
To that. Look, there is no question that in trying to rally their base, the Republican establishment has pushed the idea that Obama is a complete and total radical who is a threat to the American way of life, and that's gotten folks stirred up. There is no question about that.
Michael Bloomberg coming in the race. He says if it's Trump v. Sanders, he might come in. What do you think?
My colleagues had a great story about that. It wouldn't surprise me in a Trump-Sanders race if Bloomberg does, in fact, run. But I do think that his looking at this race is predicated in large part upon Sanders. I think if Hillary's the nominee, I think there is less of an opening for Bloomberg.
And right now, you're reading these two races, Trump, Cruz. Who looks in a position to take them?
I think in Iowa, Trump right now has a narrow advantage. He's had a good few days. Cruz has been hit pretty hard here. But two things. There's a lot that can change in the final 5 days. There are still plenty of voters who are not committed. And secondly, there is a debate Thursday night here. Watch for what happens after that debate. That could solidify Trump, or it could raise questions about whether or not he can win here. And also, most importantly, perhaps, we don't know who's going to show up. Is the universe of voters here in Iowa on the Republican side, is it a traditional 125, 130, or does Trump bring it out and bring it north of 150? That could make a huge difference in who wins here on caucus day.
Jonathan Martin in Des Moines, we're up against the break here. You are terrific to be with us. Thank you so much. National political correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Tom.
We are looking at the conservative case against Donald Trump. Against Trump is the big headline in National Review. The editor is with us. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the conservative case against Donald Trump and a bit against Ted Cruz, too, and the turmoil right now in the GOP on the eve of the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire. The National Review, William F. Buckley's magazine, out huge cover headline this week, Against Trump. Its editor, Rich Lowry, joins us in just a moment. You can join us as well. What does it say that the country's top conservative publication has against Trump splashed across its cover, that Conservative Central is calling the GOP frontrunner a menace? Are they right, or are the big wigs of American conservatism missing something? Are they out of touch? Donald Trump out on the hustings just getting the job done. Here he was last night, Farmington High School, New Hampshire, told the crowd their support isn't enough. They need to get the vote out in the New Hampshire primary.
February 9th, we have to go out and vote. We got to do it. We have to bring it home, right? Going to bring it home.
Going to bring it home. National Review, not the first one to say there's a problem with Trump. Jeb Bush put it right in an ad and put it in one word, jerk.
Just one other thing, I got to get this off my chest. Donald Trump is a jerk.
Has Donald Trump seen the National Review headline? Well, he knows enough to comment on it. Here he was in Las Vegas on Thursday after they unveiled their issue against Trump, criticizing the paper.
Look, the National Review is a dying paper. It's got its circulation's way down. Not very many people read it anymore. I mean, people don't even think about the National Review. So I guess they want to get a little publicity. But, you know, that's a dying paper.
Well, they're getting a lot of publicity off this cover, and it's more than about publicity. There's a real battle on here, maybe for the soul of conservatism and the GOP. The editor of the National Review, Rich Lowry, joins us now from New York. Syndicated columnist, commentator for the Fox News Channel, also writes for Political and Time, author of Legacy, Paying the Price for the Clinton Years. Rich Lowry, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Does your magazine matter when you get up in the jet stream where politics are happening now? Can you make a difference?
Well, there are a couple purposes of what we did. One is just to put down the marker and hold up a banner for Buckleyite, Reaganite conservatism, and to make the case that Donald Trump is not a conservative. He really has shown very little interest in limited government or liberty or the Constitution, the animating causes of American conservatism for the last 50 years, and National Review, across the decades of its existence, has always opposed this kind of crude populism represented by Donald Trump, whether its exemplar was George Wallace or Pat Buchanan or Ross Perot. So we, it's our business to stand up for this kind of conservatism, even if people don't want to hear it, even if it's unpopular, even if the candidate we're criticizing is at 30 or 40 or 50 or 90% in the polls. It doesn't matter.
You write, and you've got a lot of tough essays in here, but you write the big one, the cover essay by the editors of National Review. You're self-right at the head of that league. Trump is a philosophically unmoored political opportunist who would trash the broad conservative ideological consensus within the GOP in favor of a free-floating populism with strongman overtones. I want to work back through your conservative argument against Donald Trump, but take us to the end point. If he should win the nomination, if he should win the presidency, what is the threat that you're describing there?
Well, he at the very least is an a-constitutional candidate. He shows very little interest in the Constitution, seems to have no understanding of the restraints that the Constitution puts on popular majorities and on elected officials. And I'm afraid that part of Donald Trump's appeal is the sense that he would do what Obama has done, kind of rule unilaterally in important respects, and give it to the other side good and hard. And I understand the appeal of that, but it's not a worthy sentiment. And after this kind of new dispensation of executive power under the Obama administration, it's very important for Republicans to nominate and get behind someone who will govern differently. Otherwise, this post-constitutional government will become a new norm with really grave consequences for the republic.
Of course, a lot of Democrats would argue with that characterization, but it's out there. It's widespread in the GOP. You published David Boaz, VP at the Cato Institute, libertarian outfit, saying he's effectively Trump, effectively vowing to be an American Mussolini. You published that. What do you see in Donald Trump's background or his comments on the campaign trail that leads you to endorse that, Rich Lowry?
Well, David is a libertarian, and he says a number of things in his contribution that don't really reflect the National Review line. One of the purposes we had in this feature was to gather together 20 or so people from across the spectrum, and that included religious conservatives, included libertarians, included neocons and non-neocons, old, young, activists, intellectuals, you name it. So David is part of that stew. So
hey, fair enough, but you say strongman overtones. So you're nudging into the same terrain there. And I'm just asking, what is it in his history or his comments that leads you to say that?
Well, it's obviously the affect and the kind of whiny, vindictive attitude towards any criticism and the promises of doing things that it's beyond his power to do. How is he going to make Mexico pay for the wall, for instance? You know, these are, how is he going to steal Iraq's oil? These are things that really would be impossible to do under our system. And I give him some credit just for being ignorant of how our system works and of the Constitution. But there is certainly a kind of a strongman flavor to Trump. And it's part of his appeal. You know, strength is important to people. But again, it has to be moored to certain ideals and to constitutional constraints.
Lead editorial in the big against Trump issue, Rich Lowry's National Review. Conclusion, Donald Trump is a menace to American conservatism who would take the work of generations and trample it underfoot on behalf of a populism as heedless and crude as the Donald himself. Rich Lowry is editor of the National Review. He's with us from New York. And Rich, you've got plenty of listeners with questions for you. Eric in Phelps, Wisconsin. Eric, you're on with Rich Lowry.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Rich.
Hi,
I had a quick question. I was trying to, I just wanted the guest to describe the difference that he thinks the difference is between a conservative and an established Republican. I think that there's huge damage done to conservatives when the conservative label gets slapped on to just about every Republican politician in Congress right now.
Rich Slattery, what do you think? We just heard from, thank you, Eric. We heard from Jonathan Martin as well, saying, look, you've got your thinkers, like you, conservative thinkers who can't deal with Trump because he's not ideologically pure. You've got mainstream Republicans, sort of lobbyist strategist, Martin was saying, who can't deal with Cruz because he's so arch conservative they're afraid he would blow things up. Our caller's just looking for a definition. You know, how do you define conservatism, and does it match up with mainstream Republican today? A bunch of Tea Partiers might say no.
Well, a couple things. Defining the establishment, I think very loosely what can be fairly described as the establishment is kind of high Republican office holders, senators, members of the Republican leadership, donors, kind of big-time donors, consultants who have been around forever, lobbyists. Now, there are all sorts of differences among those people. Mike Lee, for instance, take an example, is a senator, but no one will ever mistake him as an establishment Republican. A conservative is someone who believes in these certain ideas and principles having to do with limited government and liberty, the Constitution, how you achieve them, and believes they're best for a free society. And they're establishment Republicans who might believe those things but be more accommodationist, and then there are establishment Republicans who might be more moderate. It's not a simple black and white question. And the phrase establishment is very convenient to throw around now because kind of no one quite knows it, what it is. At the same time, the establishment is completely hated. At the same time, the establishment has very little power. And speaking of the establishment, I would just mention one of our purposes with his features to make the case that it isn't just the establishment opposing Donald Trump.
Okay.
As we speak, and as Jonathan, I'm sure, told you and has written in his paper, the establishment's hiding under his desk and figuring out how to co-opt and deal with Donald Trump, and hates Ted Cruz with a passion. And just one thing I think that's extremely unwise is to let their personal feelings for Ted Cruz push them into the arms of Donald Trump, which I find just perverse and very short-sighted.
We'll look at Ted Cruz. Of course, last week he was out with Sarah Palin. She had the microphone, and she, Sarah Palin, former vice presidential candidate of the Republican Party, going after the GOP machine, the establishment.
Our own GOP machine, the establishment, they who would assemble the political landscape, they're attacking their own front runner. Now, would the left ever, would the DNC ever come after their front runner and her supporters? No, because they don't eat their own. They don't self-destruct.
And Sarah Palin had more.
How about the rest of us? Right-wing and bitter clinging, proud clingers of our guns, our God, our religions, and our Constitution. Tell us that we're not red enough. Yeah, coming from the establishment, right.
National Review, where were you on Sarah Palin? She's now attacking the establishment for going after front runner Donald Trump.
I love it. It's like a poetry jam, a right-wing poetry jam. I love it.
Free association.
Yeah. Look, the idea that no one should attack a Republican frontrunner, that's an anti-establishment sentiment. The idea that Democrats wouldn't attack their frontrunner when you have Bernie Sanders attracting these enormous crowds and potentially going to take Hillary Clinton down in Iowa and New Hampshire. One of the reactions to our feature that I've been most appalled by is the sense that you just can't tell people what your opinion is, and especially if your opinion doesn't seem to accord with the polling. I mean, what standard is that? You know, so we just planted this banner. We'll let the chips fall where they may. This is what we think. We want to persuade as many people of it, but obviously people at the end of the day make their choice. But it's a really poor way to choose a presidential candidate, to look at the person who is ahead in the polls and say, therefore, he or she shouldn't be attacked. And by that standard, no one should have attacked Jeb Bush a year ago.
First Amendment, freedom of speech, off we go. David in Charleston, South Carolina, you're on the air with Rich Slattery, David.
Hi, how are you? I just had a couple comments. I live in Charleston, South Carolina, and I've got a lot of friends who are Trump supporters. I don't happen to be a Trump supporter, to be quite frank, but I listen to these guys. No offense, but you guys are so out of touch with the Republican anger on the streets today with the establishment. And I got to tell you, it's not just the Obama establishment. It's the Republican establishment. These guys are angry. They want change. And right now, they're looking at Trump as the only alternative. The rest of the establishment candidates, I'll be quite frank, they're looked at as a bunch of weak chumps who are just going to follow the lead of whatever the establishment puts out there. And I got to tell you, I think Trump is unstoppable on the day-to-day streets out there, the people I talk to. I don't think the establishment has a prayer.
David, I appreciate your call. Rich Lowry, too late to reconnoiter and regroup around one of these, you know, Trump says they're milquetoast, the other guys.
Well, one, I do get the anger, and we have written many, many pieces about Trump's appeal. It's obviously he's tapping into that anger. The issue of immigration, it really is impossible to overestimate the importance of that signature issue of Donald Trump, because this is the issue where the elites of both parties, Republican and Democrat, are most out of touch with popular sentiment, and Trump just communicates strength. Even when he doesn't know what he's talking about or even when he's been caught out, he always seems commanding and confident. But I would make the case that if you really want someone to shake up the establishment, Donald Trump is not your guy. You know, that's the way it may feel at the moment, but I guarantee you the moment he wraps up the nomination, and we're already seeing some of this, you know, he's talking about how he can get along with the establishment and the establishment's reaching out to him. The moment he wins the nomination, he will rebrand himself as a moderate deal maker. Say, look, I was never that conservative. National Review and all these people attacked me. I'm a pragmatist. I can work with anyone. And that's more true to who he is than kind of the right-wing image we're getting right now. Whether it's too late, I have no idea.
I mean,
I have no idea.
You may be right, though. You've got, you know, David Boas saying American Mussolini headed for office if he wins. Is there a sense in which, having supported the McCain-Palin ticket, that you are reaping the whirlwind here with Donald Trump, that there has, look, anger and fear can work in politics, that the GOP pushed those pedals too hard and now it's coming back to bite in the Trump candidacy?
I mean, I don't think that's a fair criticism of us. Well, of course we've supported McCain-Palin versus Obama-Biden. I mean, that's kind of a no-brainer if you're anywhere on the right.
I guess so, but you know, when I listened to Sarah Palin just now there and putting her a heartbeat from the presidency, I don't know. You, a sober assessment could think maybe not a good idea.
Well, I mean, we can argue that this way and that, but it really has very little to do with Donald Trump. And look, we have been warning Republicans on immigration for a very long time. We have opposed with all of our power every single one of these so-called comprehensive immigration bills that have come down the pike. You know, we fought and killed one in 06. We fought and killed one right after the 2012 election, by the way, when Donald Trump was criticizing nice, polite Mitt Romney for his comment about self-deportation, which is just a way of saying we're going to enforce our laws and treat the illegal population. That's what Donald Trump was saying a few years ago. Now, all of a sudden, he's going to deport everyone, and we're supposed to believe him. I mean, on a signature issue, he is not even believable. And we've also, at NR, we've talked constantly about how the Republican Party needs a more working-class-oriented economics. It needs to get beyond the stale orthodoxies of you know, the 1980s. And there have been a lot of conservatives who are like, oh, this is so squishy, you guys are so wishy-washy. And some of these same people are now on the Trump bandwagon, which is for us a little unbelievable, because Trump doesn't believe any of this stuff, whereas we were trying to tap into some of this populist sentiment within a conservative framework. And we still think that's possible and it should be done, and there are lessons to be learned from Donald Trump without nominating the guy.
You've got a racism raised by Michael Medved in your Against Trump issue. Nationalism, populism, Rush Limbaugh, not so sure it's a bad thing. He's sounded kind of positive on Trump, hasn't endorsed yet, but here he is talking about those two. Rush Limbaugh.
What's happening here? Nationalism, dirty word. Ooh, people hate it. Populism, even dirtier word. Nationalism and populism have overtaken conservatism in terms of appeal.
Rich Lowry, what do you say?
I mean, there's certainly a lot of Republican voters, and this is something we've been saying for a long time, who aren't ideologues and aren't necessarily attached to our doctrines. And limited government conservatism is an inherently fragile thing. It's always under threat and needs tending and defending. And for us, again, it doesn't matter whether Rush is right or not. Maybe he is right, but we're still here to try to advance a limited government conservatism, even if it's not going to carry the day this time, even if it's going to be eclipsed for some period of time in the Republican Party. National Review was born in opposition. We've ebbed and flowed. I'm hoping we're going to flow. But even if we ebb, we're going to stand by what we consider the truth.
Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, please stand by. In New York, we have lots of callers for you. As we speak, Jerry Falwell Jr. endorsing Donald Trump just days before the Iowa caucuses. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast is made possible by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace websites help you capture every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com. When you're ready to purchase, use the one-word offer code ONPOINT to save 10%. You should. Squarespace.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the conservative case against Donald Trump. Some jabs against Ted Cruz, too. Some pro as well in the latest issue of National Review. The huge cover headline, Against Trump. And we're looking at the turmoil right now in the GOP on the eve of the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire. The editor of the National Review, Rich Lowry, is with us from New York. And you can join us. Republicans, do you agree? Trump's no conservative? True conservatives, are you freaking out? What has brought us to this moment? If it's Trump in Iowa, New Hampshire, then what? If it's Cruz, will party loyalty trump all in the end when it comes to the general, if that's where we're headed here with these guys? Campaign in event in Sioux City, Iowa on Saturday. Donald Trump, not exactly mincing words, said his supporters are super loyal to him, even if he were to shoot someone in the streets of New York.
My people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Hey, how about that for an idea? On Monday, conservative radio host Glenn Beck, one of those who have come out against Donald Trump in the National Review, big spread of essays, talked with CNN's Chris Cuomo about Trump on this front.
Donald Trump, I really, truly believe, is a very dangerous man. If you listen to, Chris, some of the things he said this weekend.
Dangerous,
I could go out
why?
On...
Obviously.
I could go on at Fifth Avenue
ahead.
And I could shoot
Please.
People and I wouldn't lose a single vote. He's joked about killing reporters like Putin. Actually, he's joked about not killing reporters like Putin does. He's a very dangerous man.
Trump says he's not worried. Here he is in Las Vegas last week.
I have received so many phone calls from people that you would call establishment, from people, generally speaking, conservatives, Republicans, that want to come onto our team. The polls have just come out, as you saw in Iowa, where I'm up by 11 points.
Up by 11 points. Against Trump is the big headline. Will it make a difference in this last week and more as we head into the actual voting of this season? Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review, is with us from New York. Anthony's calling from Philadelphia. Anthony, you're on with the new National Review editor.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what do you see?
What I see, and I don't think that this has come up in the conversation so far, what you've located is a sort of a general anger among Republican voters, but it does seem to me that that anger is at least in part located in a white working class that is starting to realize that Republican economic policy just isn't good for them. I mean, the way that the Republican Party drew the white working class, at least a large segment of it, away from the Democrats in the 60s and 70s and 80s was through social issues. And I mean, it's kind of the, you know, the Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas thesis, but it seems that, I mean, it does seem to me a reality that was fine, that the white working class would vote for Republicans in prosperous economic times based upon a kind of a more social conservatism. But as their economic position declines, what they're seeing is that, well, the Republican Party, as it always has been, right, since its founding, has been the party of business in this country. And they're just, Republican economic policy isn't good for them. I mean, furthermore, it seems to me that this isn't just about anger, that it's about the future of the party. If the white working class voters turn away from the Republican Party, and that party is doomed. It's done.
You've got a lot on the table there. Rich Lowry, how do you respond? Is there a fundamental tension here? I mean, when you've got Jerry Falwell Jr. coming out and endorsing Trump, who has by no means been exceptionally known for his religiosity, does that mean that the values voter, social conservatism era is over, that it's white working class, more urgent issues? And could that drive people away from what has been Republican orthodoxy here and right to Trump, Rich.
Well, Tom, if you don't mind, can I address the question? Because I think the questioner, it was extremely thoughtful.
Yes.
What he said.
Please do.
Very well said, and I think basically spot on. And part of the appeal of Trump, he's not the Republican donor class. And you talk to some of these people, as I occasionally do, or, you know, I'm invited to speak to meetings and whatnot, and they're really convinced that the party needs to dump its cultural conservatism and just kind of double down on donor-oriented supply-side economics. And you try to explain, no, actually, a lot of these voters, a lot of our voters and people we need to get as Republicans don't like our economics. So if you dump the cultural conservatism, there's nothing left to appeal to them. And Trump, in terms of his style and his positioning within the party, he's really tapping into that. At the same time, he's thought none of this through. Because his tax plan, it's basically a slightly souped-up version of Jeb Bush's tax plan, which is itself just very traditional Republican economics. So we've been urging the party to look at this differently, to take what the caller is saying very seriously, take the concerns of those kind of voters very seriously, figuring out how we can have a tax reform that is good for working families, figuring out how we can address the problem of spiraling college costs with conservative solutions, and how we can address the costs of health care. And this is part of the Trump phenomenon that I think is actually healthy. We've had such a desiccated economic debate within the party. Perhaps Trump can kind of open up some space where there hasn't been any before for some new thinking and new ideas on this front.
But maybe you can't do it without him. I mean, maybe the GOP is a captive of the donor class. We had David Frum on recently saying pretty much exactly that. Maybe you need a populist like Trump to blow that door open.
Well, I'm working on a piece with my colleague that sort of says the worst case scenario coming from where we are now is Trump gets a nomination, he loses, but he still kind of reorients the Republican Party against limited government conservatism, which, again, for all the reasons we've been talking about for 20 minutes, is very important to us. But another really bad outcome would be, as we want, Trump is defeated in the nomination battle, and then everyone goes on as if nothing has happened and we've learned nothing from this phenomenon. And, Tom, just at the risk of repeating myself, the party needs to learn from Trump at the same time it doesn't nominate him. And that is going to be our message.
Learn and reject, says National Review editor.
It's a two-step process.
Two-step. Doing the two-step here. Rich, Jeffrey Lord is with us for a second here from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, author of What America Needs, The Case for Trump. He is contributing editor, columnist at The American Spectator, columnist at Conservative Review, former associate political director in the Reagan White House, CNN political commentator. What America Needs, The Case for Trump is the book. Jeff Lord, Rich Lowry's whole magazine says no, no, no. You're still saying yes. Why?
Well, hello, Tom. Thanks for having me. And hello to Rich, whom we've never actually met, but we have sort of communicated in the way of conservatives with this or that column over time. Well, I have a column this morning in the American Spectator headed William F. Buckley Questions National Review on Trump.
How do you know that?
I came across an old video of William F. Buckley. I have no idea when it was, but he's clearly a much younger man. And one of the lines that jumped out at me, he was talking about his very famous line about how we'd rather be governed by the first 2,000 people in the Boston Telephone Directory than by the 2,000 people on the faculty of Harvard University. But one of the other things he said that really leapt out at me, he says, as Franklin Adams once said, he was a columnist, I think the average American is a little bit above average. And under the circumstances, I rejoice over the influence of the people over their elected leaders, since by and large, I think that they show more wisdom than their leaders or than their intellectuals. I found that particularly striking in light of Rich's whole piece here on this. I think that Donald Trump really has struck a nerve with people for multiples of reasons. One, I think, has nothing to do with either politics or with either the economy or national security, although it certainly touches on them. And that's political correctness, which I think is serving to some degree as rocket fuel here. Donald Trump, as we all know by now, is not politically correct. He's not politically correct personally. He doesn't believe in it. I think that there are a lot of Americans out there who once found this sort of vaguely amusing decades ago and perhaps a little irritating over time, but we've now reached a point where it ranges from the silly and the bizarre. You can't say Merry Christmas. There was one Trump supporter who'd worked at an Ohio university who said she wasn't allowed to say his or her because it would upset transgenders.
I mean, everything you're saying could be true, and you could still be against
Donald. As I mentioned in the book, to Major Hassan shooting all these soldiers at an American base, and we find out that the Army knew that he had these tendencies, was proselytizing for jihad. They didn't want to touch him because of political correctness. And, of course, the San Bernardino thing where the neighbors didn't want to report anybody because of political correctness. Donald Trump is flatly, I think, an answer, a rebuff to this, and I think people are responding to that.
Jeff, stand by. Rich Lowry, there's the suggestion that William F. Buckley would be a Trump guy.
Well, look, it's no news that Bill Buckley had a big streak of populism, as conservatism has, and it's because the elite institutions of this country are arrayed against us, and almost all of the intellectuals in this country are arrayed against us. But this is, as I said, this isn't new. But if you look at Bill's record pushing back against George Wallace or Pat Buchanan or Ross Perot, as we were talking about earlier, other champions of this kind of populism, it's clear that he rejected it. And in fact, if you want to hone in on Donald Trump himself, Trump says, oh, Buckley would be so ashamed of National Review. Actually, Buckley wrote about Donald Trump in 2000 and said he was a narcissist and a demagogue. And I submit to you, nothing has changed in the last 15 years. And I agree with Jeffrey in almost everything he says about Trump's appeal, and I've written about it extensively myself. I would just add something on the political correctness. This is a guy who does not himself have great appreciation for free speech. He's out there cheerleading for us to die and be shut down because we've said things that he disagrees with. When I had very sharp words for how one of the early debates went with him in exchange with Carly Fiorina, he wanted to be defined by the FCC and banned from TV. So those of us who are principled opponents of PC, we actually appreciate free speech across the board, and we appreciate debate even when it annoys us or we disagree with us. You know, Jeffrey has criticized National Review a whole lot over the years back when he himself was a conservative purist, and I don't mind it. I think it's good. But if I were Donald Trump, I'd be inveighing against him, calling him a loser, calling him incompetent, calling him to get fired and shut down. That is not a conservative sentiment in the least.
Jeff Lord, you say he's not PC, and you welcome that. He's popular. That's clear in the polls. What about that doesn't mean he's a conservative, though. I mean, they've got David Boaz saying he's effectively vowing to be an American Mussolini. They got Michael Mukasey, former Attorney General under George Bush, saying we don't need a president who summons applause with tantrums and homicidal fantasies. He may not be PC, okay, but is he conservative?
Well, certainly he's a conservative, small C. I mean, what people are getting at here is he Ronald Reagan? Now, is he Reagan-like? Yes. Is he Ronald Reagan? No, of course. There are no two human souls are alike. He's not Ronald Reagan. But he does have, I think, a very good understanding of the fundamentals of economics. His economic program has been given a thumbs up by Larry Kudlow, who was one of my colleagues from the Reagan era and who is, of course, no liberal. So I think that he's fine on these matters, but he does want to challenge the status quo. And to be perfectly candid here, and I certainly don't want to shut down National Review. I love National Review, even though I'm critical of it, you know, tough love and all of that kind of thing.
Okay.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
My friend,
yeah,
my
friend is one-minded of you.
You
might be the most liberal Trump supporter out there.
My friends at National Review back in December of 2007 ran a cover from the editors endorsing Mitt Romney for president. Now, Mitt Romney, who, as I detail in this morning's column, when he ran for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts in 1994, he just switched from the being an independent to the Republican Party and in his debates with Ted Kennedy made a point of saying, no, he didn't want to do the Reagan-Bush thing. No. And this is 6 years after Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, we got it. We know the Romney history. We're looking at Trump here.
Romney Care, which is the godfather of Obamacare, and here is National Review saying, he's just great. He's our limited government guy. And I would respectfully suggest that it's that kind of thing that has brought about this reaction from so many people who think conservatives and Republicans have long since abandoned the field.
Got it. Tommy in Greenville, Alabama. Tommy, you're on with Rich Lowry and Jeff Lord.
Rich, I totally support what you're saying. Trump is a loose cannon, and you know all he can do in retort when he's questioned or challenged is say your poll numbers are not as good as mine.
Mm.
It's a glorified TV show, and I reject the notion that he's really a true conservative. I wish people would give Ben Carson another thought. He made some missteps early, I know, but he's thoughtful and very provocative, brilliant, and.
Tommy, we got it. You're solid against Trump, solid for Carson. No conservative, you say, from Greenville. One more right here, if I may. Peggy in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Peggy, you're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
I'm humbled to be in such great company here, and your show's very interesting. But I usually don't call into such things, but I couldn't ignore the fact that I'm kind of taking on the stand that Sarah Palin did in a way, in that I feel like we should support the person who's sort of indicating that they are going to be the front runner. He's not yet. He hasn't been elected, in the primary.
Peggy, our time is short. Forgive me, but
okay,
the clock
but
is ticking. Who are you for? Are you for Trump?
Wharton. He's got a degree from Wharton, and he went to a military academy, and his net worth is the size of a small country. So, yes, I do support him because I feel like he can solve our biggest problem.
Which is the economy. Rich Lowry, there's Peggy. Come on. He went to Wharton. He went to military academy. He can fix the economy. Let's go. And he's leading.
We were talking about
this winning
earlier. This is an attitude that is inimical to the conservative belief of how you look at the conservative view of government. You don't just get a strong, effective guy to run government. You cut it down, you return it to its constitutional bounds, and you focus it on what's important. And, you know, it's just extraordinary. I mean, if you can come back to what Jeffrey was saying earlier, we endorsed Mitt Romney in 07 because we were trying to stop John McCain, a progressive Republican who admired Teddy Roosevelt and wanted to model himself on him and supported campaign finance reform, even though it violated the First Amendment. And Romney was the best of many flawed alternatives. But the idea that Jeffrey would support any other candidate who has praised single-payer health care, has defended eminent domain
Trump,
and the use
Trump.
Of it for private property, who's obsessed with the polls, who's now talking about how he's going to get along with the establishment and cut deals. This Jeff has made wholly no new rules, as many others have, for Donald Trump, and it's totally contradictory to what were supposed to be his past principles.
Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, the headline against Trump. Jeff Lord, What America Needs, the Case for Trump. Thanks to you both. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.